Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. I'm sure you've heard the saying, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Well, our guest today says maybe it's better to say beauty is in the brain of the beholder. We'll be talking about beauty and attraction today and how they've evolved with our guest, Michael Ryan. He is the Clark Hubbs Regents Professor in Zoology at the University of Texas, a Senior Research Associate at the Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute in Panama. And he's a leading researcher in the field of sexual selection, mate choice, and animal communication. And his new book is titled A Taste for the Beautiful, The Evolution of Attraction. Talking with him, and I hope you'll join in with your questions about how animals or humans have evolved to attract the opposite sex. Love to hear from you. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. Send us an email to ideas@wpr.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'd certainly love to hear from you. And Michael Ryan, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Well, thanks for having me on, Larry. My pleasure.
This is really, I tell you, I really enjoyed your book. I've got a ton of notes that I took as I read it about all these fascinating little things that you and other researchers have found about attraction. But tell us how you got interested in researching attraction to begin with.
Well, I spend most of my time studying frogs and how they communicate with each other. And there's about 6,000 species of frogs, and they all make these long-distance mating calls. And the mating calls have really important information for the females. It tells the females which species a male belongs to. And if a female mates with the wrong species, well, that's pretty bad because all of their eggs are wasted. But then what I found is that frogs and a lot of other animals, they add these really fancy additions to their sexual displays, in this case, frogs. So these frogs, the first part of their call sounds like a whine, like this, and then they add something on it called a chuck.
I actually have some of those sounds. Do you want to hear them?
Oh, great. Yeah, let's hear them. So it sounds like a video game in the forest when you first hear it.
It must. It's fascinating. Those little chucks are those. It sounds almost like little pieces of static.
Exactly. And the whine has all this important information about what species is calling, but the chuck, it ends up, all that does is it stimulates the female's brain, and we know exactly where in the brain it's being stimulated. And this causes the females to prefer these calls with chucks to the calls without chucks. But males don't always make chucks. So if a male's calling by himself, he'll sound like this, and then if I just mimic the call, if I say to him, he responds, and if I say, then he responds, So they only add these chucks when they're competing with other males. So we wondered, how come? Why don't they just always make the most attractive call? Well, it doesn't take any more energy to make that call. But what that call does is it attracts frog-eating bats. And the bats listen to the calls, and they swoop down, and they capture the calling male. And the more chucks that the male makes, the easier it is for the bat to find him.
So the male is, he's, okay, I'd like to have sex, but I also don't want to be eaten. So there's a fine line they try to draw.
Yeah, and the females really like the calls with chucks. When a male adds a chuck, his attractiveness increases 500%, which is amazing, just by adding this little burp to his sound.
Well, how did that get you from studying those frogs to a more general look at what a taste for the beautiful, an evolution of attraction?
Well, for a long time, researchers have been, you know, they've always been interested. We've always been interested in this diversity of beauty, you know, bird songs and colorful patterns in fishes and birds and frogs calling and insects chirping and mammals making all of these odors. But people had been mostly concentrating on the male side of it, because it's usually the males that are the ones that are more decked out, and the females decide whom they want to mate with. But people trying to figure out how this process evolved by almost concentrating only on the males and not on the females. And then, because we're working on the brains of the females, trying to understand how the brain makes some calls more attractive, we realize that we can't understand the evolution of beauty unless we look at this beauty through the eyes of the individuals that make decisions about beauty. And in most species, that's the females. So that's why we say beauty is in the brain of the beholder, because some females are looking for colors, some are listening for sounds, some are sniffing for scents.
And those are the, talk about how you've kind of put your book together, because, well, you actually almost did, because you talk about the brain, you talk about, well, go ahead, tell us.
Yeah, so we first talk about how in various species the animals have traits that make them more attractive to females. And then we address this conundrum that so troubled Darwin. Darwin wrote a letter to one of his supporters, and he said, every time I look at a peacock's tail, it makes me sick. And then, but why would a naturalist like Darwin be driven to illness by such a spectacular ornament? And what it was a little dose of cognitive dissonance. Darwin just developed this theory of natural selection to explain the evolution of adaptations for survival. And now he's seeing all of these animals burdened with these traits that actually increase mortality, like the tail of a peacock and the chucks of these tundra frogs. So then we point out that there's this trade-off between survivorship and attraction. Quite often, the more attractive males are going to have the higher mortality because of all of these costs of their displays.
It's really a fascinating story. In your book, you talk about the sexual brain. How does the sexual brain work?
Well, there's not only one nucleus, one area in the brain that determines sex and the want and the need for sex. But part of the sexual brain are the parts of the brain that receive the stimulus information. So when we're talking about calls, for instance, there's a part of the brain in humans and all other animals that decodes information in sound. So if your sexual display is acoustic, then that part of the brain is involved. But then also, what's very important is this dopamine reward system, which in humans can be hijacked and result in addictions for gambling, addictions for overeating, even addictions for viewing pornography. And this reward system appears to be important in females evaluating the male's attractiveness. But we do know that, you know, it's been said that the brain is our most important sex organ, and that's, you know, more or less true. But the brain has other things on its mind, and that's one thing that we're very interested in. Yeah. When the brain evolves to do other tasks, how does that influence our percepts of beauty?
And I tell you, for most people, when you say something is beautiful, they assume it's something you can see. And visual beauty is important to attraction. And I'm wondering the role of color. Let's take color. What is the role of color in visual beauty? What role does it play?
Well, it very much depends on the species. So, for instance, in guppies, which are found in the wild in these streams in Trinidad, and another wonderful study of surf perch that are found in the kelp forests in coastal California, the visual sensitivity of those fishes, they evolved to best find food. So for instance, with the guppies, orange fruits fall from trees into these streams, and the guppies feed on the orange fruits. Well, the researchers have argued that the visual sensitivity to orange first evolved so they could find fruit. Now, once you have this bias in your brain, once the fish has this bias in their brain in place, then the males evolve orange color to make it easier for the females to notice them so they can stand out better.
And so they'll pick orange males over males that are less orange in color.
Exactly. So the guppies have this, female guppies have this very strong preference for orange. And researchers have argued that it actually originated in for foraging rather than originating for sex.
And the poor peacock, the male peacock, talk about the male peacock and what it kind of has to put up with.
Yeah, so the male peacock's tail is about a meter long, and he erects it when he courts the females, and there's these eye spots on it, and he shakes the tail. It would almost look like he's hypnotizing the female. And when you look at these birds, they're just so magnificent. I'm in Austin, Texas, and we have a park nearby that has a lot of peacocks. And I would bring my girls there when they were little, and we would watch the males displaying to the females. And then my girls would chase the birds. And the males could hardly get away from them because they're dragging this yard-long tail behind them. My girls would catch them, and they'd grab their tails, and I'd have to pry their hands off their tails. But the males can barely fly, so it's a very costly ornament to invest in, but they're between a rock and a hard place. If they don't have these spectacular tails, they don't get any mates. But if their tails are too spectacular, they're not going to live long because they're such an easy target for predators.
It's interesting. Sounds, or sometimes the lack of sounds, can be an attractant. I was interested in several things in the sound area. One, the city birds that you talk about, how they've developed a sound to deal with noise, city noise.
Right. So there's a lot of birds now, obviously, in urban areas, and urban areas can be quite loud with a lot of anthropogenic, a lot of industrial noises. And most of this work has been done in Europe with this bird called the great tit. And what they find is that when these birds are singing in the cities, they are singing at a higher frequency, a higher pitch than their neighbors of the same species in rural areas. So then what they show is that this higher pitch gets above the urban noise, because the urban noise is usually the lower in frequencies, if you think of the noise generated by traffic especially. So these birds are increasing the pitch of their call, and then what the researchers have shown is that this then makes them more attractive to females because the females can more easily hear their calls.
It's fascinating. And sounds, when it comes to humans, you talk about diction in your book and how diction can play a role.
Right. Well, we probably most of us know about My Fair Lady, and in that book, the book was Pygmalion, and in the movie My Fair Lady, they're trying to have this person speak in a more attractive dialect. So people have done studies where they play to women sentences spoken by men of different socioeconomic classes. And this was done in Scotland. And they would just ask the women, which version of this sentence do you find more attractive? And women preferred the diction of people with higher levels of education. So basically people who were using less slang, and also people who were enunciating the words better.
Talking today with Michael Ryan. He is the author of A Taste for the Beautiful, The Evolution of Attraction. Great to have him along. What do you know about attraction in animals? What questions do you have about the differences maybe in coloring between females and males of different species? I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@WPR.org or post on our Facebook page. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network. Right now, talking, though, with Michael Ryan, professor in zoology at the University of Texas and author of A Taste for the Beautiful, The Evolution of Attraction. What do you know about attraction? Any experiences you can share there? Give a call, 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@WPR.org. We'd love to hear from you. One of the things, Michael, I was glad to see was the way you wrote this book. You have written this book for a broad audience rather than a scientific one. And why did you decide to do that?
Well, I spend a lot of time teaching, obviously, since I'm a professor. And what I find is that students in general find this area of sexual attraction so interesting, as do lots of friends and family of mine who don't have a science background. And I thought it would be good for me to share with the general public these wonderful stories just about something that we take for granted in other animals, and that is sexual attraction.
Yeah. So one story when it comes, there are a few relating to sounds that I enjoyed. Well, I enjoyed all of them, actually. But the male corn borers have developed a tone that works in some ways in a kind of insidious way, I thought. But talk about the corn borer.
Yeah, that's a fascinating story. So the corn borer is a moth. And bats, again, enter into the story. Bats love to eat moths. Moths have evolved the ability to hear the bats' echolocation calls, which are really high frequency ultrasounds. We can't hear them. And the moths have also evolved the ability to make sounds to jam the bats' echolocation calls. So now you have these corn borers. And the corn borers use these sound-producing and sound-detecting systems that evolved to avoid predation from bats. They now use it in a courtship. So if we could hear the sounds, the males would make a sound like this to the female while they're courting. But then all of a sudden, the males start to make this sound very, very quickly. Now, when a bat is hunting a moth, it starts making echolocation calls. When the bat gets close to the moth, it makes these sounds really fast, so it can get information much more quickly about the moth's location. And this sound is called the feeding buzz. Well, what the male corn borer does, when he starts to court the female, he will make sounds that sound exactly like the feeding buzz of a bat. So this causes the female to freeze because she thinks there's a bat about. And while she's frozen, the male just nonchalantly climbs on top of the female, mates with her, and then walks away with the female still frozen in this anti-predatory behavior.
Oh, it's kind of sneaky.
Very sneaky, yeah.
More than kind of, yeah, very sneaky. Well, let's take some calls. You can join in again at 1-800-642-1234. Let's turn to Cindy in Verona. Cindy, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you for the show. I raise sheep, and I have observed some certain behaviors in the sheep that I'd like to get a reaction to. normally the rams are separated from the ewes, and before we begin breeding, we often put the rams on one side of a fence and the ewes on the opposite side, just so that the ewes become aware of the rams, and sometimes it gets their cycles to sync up, which works better for breeding. But I've observed that the ewes will arrange themselves in kind of a line, as if they're at the start of a race. All their noses are lined up, and they will move across the pasture in this line while the rams are on the opposite side of the fence, mesmerized by this behavior. And I'm wondering if what's going on there, if this might be a defensive thing because of the presence of the rams, or if they're sort of putting themselves on parade.
Wow, that's fascinating. I haven't heard of that. And it could be either. It could be defensive for sure. But it also could be that they're, as you pointed out, they're advertising their wares to the males. So in a lot of animals, the males will get together and do something like that. And it's called lekking, where the males just all gather together, stay put, and then the females get to choose which of those males they want for a mate. It usually doesn't happen the other way, but under domestication, lots of different things can evolve. But it certainly might be that the females are, in a sense, lining up, and the males will choose which are the more attractive females, and in this case, probably the healthier females, and also the females that are more ready to reproduce.
Mm, interesting. Thanks, Cindy.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate the call. You can join in, too, 1-800-642-1234. I was glad to see that you have some information, or quote Patricia McConnell. Patricia and I hosted a call-in national show called Calling All Pets for many years, and she still comes and appears on my show.
Oh, that's wonderful. I met Patricia. I don't know her, but I met her when she was a graduate student doing wonderful work for her PhD on the kinds of sounds that humans, that we use to make domestic animals move versus domestic making them stop. Oh, that's wonderful to hear that.
And she, the sounds that we make are, if we're talking to a baby, we talk in one way. If we're talking to an animal, like a dog, to get that dog to move or to stop, we might use different inflections in our voice and different pitches.
Yeah, and that's what Patricia had shown, and other people have also shown that since. So, for instance, she did a study, and this was many years ago, where you raise animals, I believe these were sled dogs, and you raise them to go when you use the kind of signal you would normally use to stop, and then you raise them to stop to the signal that you normally use to mean go. And what she found was that you can train the animals to respond to these signals in the atypical way. But then when you reverse the learning, then they very quickly adapt to the more typical use of those sounds. Whereas if you raise the animals to the typical sounds to go and stop, then you really cannot reverse them to do the opposite. So there seems to be something in their nervous system where certain sounds like whoa does make an animal stop, whereas giddy up will make animals go, and that seems to be to hold across different kinds of animals. Really, it's really interesting research.
Nancy in Verona has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Nancy. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I have a question about wild turkeys.
Okay.
And a couple questions. When hunters hunt for wild turkeys, which I've never done, they make sounds, to attract the male, and then the male thinks it's the female, I believe, and then they're, that's how they can get a turkey. But also about how the males can do these beautiful dances, fanning out their tails and just strutting in front of the other males, which I've seen in person. Why are they showing off to one another?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this has been of interest for quite a long time, and at least in some places where these displays happen, they refer to these as bands of brothers. And you get these groups of males displaying together to first to themselves and then to females, and only one of those males will get to mate. And it ends up that the other males that they're displaying with tend to be closer related and often tend to be brothers. So it's as if the brothers are helping one another, in this case, helping the dominant brother attract a female.
Ah, interesting.
Wow.
It's amazing, yeah.
And, I thought it might be just practicing for the time when they would see some females, but...
But when I watched them, it seems like one gets to do all the showing. The others just seem to be standing around and watching, or maybe two of them. But I've rarely seen a display where a whole bunch of them are displaying.
Usually the dominant males would be the ones displaying, wouldn't they?
Right. And then what the thought is that the other males stay in this brotherhood, so that if the dominant male were to disappear, if he were to get killed or just migrate, then one of these males would then step up the dominance hierarchy ladder, and then they would be the showcase of this group of males.
So do they mostly show for other males, or when they find a female, they would dance for her, wouldn't they?
Yeah, when they find a female, they'll dance for the female, and only whether the subordinate males dance or not, it's usually just the dominant male that will get to mate.
Interesting. Thanks, Nancy, for calling. Appreciate your call. Jeremy on Facebook says, you spoke of the dichotomy between elongated survival and exotic expression. Normal Darwinism suggests that those most likely to survive will ultimately have their genes borne out. How do we deal with the idea that the human race might be better served from fewer of its members' reproduction?
Well, selection doesn't work as intensely on human populations as it does on populations in other animals, and also as it has in human populations in the past, mostly because of culture. So, for example, with medical advances, survivorship of humans is much higher than it would have been earlier. So although to the species, it certainly would probably benefit if our rate of reproduction was lower, but selection's just not playing as important of a role in humans now, probably because of the importance of culture.
We've talked about sounds and sight. We haven't talked about smell yet, but there were some interesting, you have some interesting research you talk about and different things about how smell, it's so much different from sounds or sight, which are you know, quick, fast. So smell, if you want to make a lasting expression, I think somewhere you say, the smell, odor is the best.
Yeah, because if, you know, we've all seen our pet dogs urinating at the edge of, you know, what they consider to be their territory. So just think, if a bird were to sing at the border of its territory, then any other bird listening would know where that territory was demarcated. But as soon as the bird stopped singing, then that signal would be gone. Odors, however, can hang around for quite a long time. So odors don't give very good information, for example, about locations. It's hard sometimes to know exactly where an odor is coming from, but the odors stay around for a very long time. And there's different kinds of information that odors can contain that others can't. So in humans, and there's real, very interesting research, in humans, body odors seem to give some indication about the genes that we have in our immune system.
I thought that was fascinating. The story you tell about women who are on the pill versus those who aren't and how they perceive smells was really interesting to me.
Yeah, this is now referred to as the stinky T-shirt experiment. And they have males wear T-shirts for a few days without showering. And then when they're done, they put the T-shirts in a plastic bag. They bring them to the lab. And then they have women smell the T-shirts and rank them in terms of their sexual attractiveness. So it ends up that there's not one type of odor, one of these T-shirts, that the women find more attractive. Different women find different odors more attractive. Now, if they look at these immune genes, and these genes are go by the abbreviation of MHC, if they look at these different MHC genes, what they show is that the females are preferring odors of males who have MHC genes that are the most different from their own. Now, this would be an adaptation for reproduction, because those genes fight pathogens much better when they're very variable. So that's been demonstrated quite clearly a number of times now. But the interesting thing is, if a woman is on an oral contraceptive, and the way oral contraceptives work is that they mimic a state of pregnancy, those women actually prefer odors of genes that are more similar to their own rather than more different. And the interpretation is that once a woman's pregnant, once she's having children, then she wants to gather around her close relatives to help raise the children. So in that sense, you would be attracted to individuals with similar genes in the immune system rather than different genes.
But I thought the interesting part of that was the discussion about if you say a woman dates someone and they're going to be married and she's been on the pill and she continues on the pill until they are ready to have a child. But then when she goes off the pill...
Exactly. Does she now find her partner not only unattractive, perhaps repulsive? And this is speculation at this point that this happens, but it seems like it's a real possibility.
So that also plays a role in, you know, you talk about some really cool, interesting research with salamanders that I thought were interesting. And people too, you know, if a man comes home and has the smell of perfume or another woman on him, the female may not be happy about that. The same even holds true of salamanders.
Yeah, the salamander study is very entertaining. So these are salamanders. They're called redback salamanders, and they live in pairs, usually in the wild. There's a male and a female. So they bring them into the lab, and they have the male and the female together in separate tanks. And then they take a male out and put the male in a tank with another female, and then they return him to the tank. And the home female can smell the odor on this, you know, quote-unquote philandering male. So what she does is she bites the male around his trunk, and she picks him up in the air, and she body slams him. So clearly showing her displeasure with his quote-unquote fooling around.
Oh, it was amazing. And when you think about... scent. I mean, when it comes to humans, the perfume industry, what is it, a $1 billion industry?
Yeah, more than $1 billion. Yeah, it's huge.
And they're, what they're looking for there is the perfume makers. What are they looking for?
Well, I mean, they're looking for scents that that we find attractive. And the way it seems that they're doing this is by employing large numbers of organic chemists and making version after version after version of scents and then testing them. And their hit rate, where they find a scent that actually will go to market, is quite low. And there's some researchers who suggest that what would be better is to do a little reverse engineering, get a better understanding of what causes us to find certain traits, certain smells attractive, and from there, from first principles, try to construct these traits. But one thing that we do know now is that if you look, if you ask people who have these different MHC genes, these different immune genes, what odors they find attractive and unattractive, there seems to be consensus. So if you have the same MHC genes of another person, you're likely to find the same kinds of odors attractive and the same kind of odors unattractive. So this suggests that part of our attraction to certain kinds of perfume might be based on how we respond to true body odors in others.
You know, as reading through your book, you quickly understand that species differ in what they see as sexual beauty. What are the commonalities that you found, though, among species?
Yeah, well, if we think about any of these traits, the first thing that's very important to a female when she's assessing a male, the thing that's most important is that she mates with the male of the correct species. Because as I said before, when you have different species breeding, usually, and there are exceptions, but usually fertilization doesn't take place. Or if fertilization takes place, then there's developmental abnormalities. So one commonality is, regardless of how species are advertising sexually, whether it's odor or sound or color, the most important thing to a female is that they get the male of the right species. Mm-hmm. Now, that doesn't seem like a big deal to us because we usually don't have that problem. I mean, how often do you find somebody at a bar with their arm around a chimpanzee? You know, we don't make those kinds of mistakes. We don't make those kinds of mistakes now, but what ancient DNA studies are showing is that there was a lot of inbreeding between Neanderthal and between Homo sapiens. So whether that was because of forced intercourse or mistaken attractions, we don't know. But then some other commonalities are preferring males with traits that would suggest that they don't have sexually transmitted diseases. So as an example, when birds have lots of feather lice, then their colors get very dull. Now, when a male bird mates with a female, it's very easy for the lice to jump off the male and land on the female. So females are avoiding males with dull colors. And one of the reasons is probably because of this these sexually transmitted parasites that they're trying to avoid. But then, the most general commonality that we find is, if we think about odor, I'm sorry, if we think about visual cues and sound, females always prefer more. They want brighter males with longer tails that are making more complex songs. And we very rarely find females preferring the opposite.
Oh, well, there's so much more that we could talk about from your book, Michael. It was really a fun read, an interesting read for me. And I want to thank you for taking time to be with us today to talk about it, Michael. Thank you so much.
Well, this is really my pleasure. Thanks a lot, Larry.
Michael Ryan, Clark Hubbs Regents Professor in Zoology at the University of Texas, author of A Taste for the Beautiful, The Evolution of Attraction. Fun talking with him. And I'll be interested in seeing his next book. He's a really good writer, and his the research that he goes to many, many, many sources for the conclusions and observations that he's made. And he writes in a style that I enjoy, and I bet you would as well. Coming up, we're going to switch gears now and talk with you about things that you can do to stay healthy so you can stay in your home. Last week, we talked about physical things. Now we're going to talk about some other things that you can do to stay healthy so you can stay in your home. Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network.